Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode of How This Is Building Me, host D. Ross Kamage, MD, PhD of the University of Colorado, is rejoined by Jeremy Paul Setnar, MD, MSHPR of Oregon Health and Science University to discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly of the lung cancer data that were presented at the 2023 ASCO annual meeting. Highlighted in the discussion include conversations around the use of adjuvant targeted therapy, tumor treating fields, and more.
Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the challenges, triumphs, ups and downs of all those who deal with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And so we're going to do a lung cancer special edition. And I thought, you know, what better way to do it, given that we're kind of bringing on early stage investigators, than to bring back one of our first alumni from How This Is Building Me, Jeremy Setnar from OHSU. Hey, Jeremy, how are you doing?
Great, Ross. Thanks for having me.
So how was ASCO 2023 for you?
It was, as most other ASCOs are, totally chaotic, but for the most part, great.
For me, the thing is, it's always exhausting. So I have meetings that start at sort of like 6:30 in the morning with breakfast meetings, and then you sort of squeeze in the actual presentations between all this stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And if you're experienced, you have in your calendar kind of like bathroom breaks as well. So how was it for you in that regard? I mean, other than the actual official presentations, what were you doing between times?
Scheduling meetings, trying to figure out which food to eat, and of course, which are the closest bathrooms. But for the most part, it was trying to figure out which in-person meetings to go to in terms of presentations, Ross. You know, there's so many presentations at so many different times. Now with the option of listening and actually watching them live, you know, right from your iPhone in your hotel room, you know, you have to be kind of a little bit picky as to which ones are you actually going to show up for in person.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's the whole kind of like live music versus recorded music sort of thing. And so there's something about being in the room, but there's also this now beauty that you can actually see stuff later and you can digest it a little bit and you can go, oh, I didn't think of that question, but that's the one I should have asked. But, you know, what was the big news from your point of view?
Well, I think ADAURA was probably the headliner in terms of it confirmed what I think we already thought we knew. But in terms of, okay, what is going to change my practice tomorrow? I would say there's a lot of thought-provoking data out there, a lot of up-and-coming studies and potential studies, Ross. But I think for me, right now, there's still a lot of things that are in the kind of pre-contemplative stage of what's the next step in the trajectory of this given drug or this class of drugs.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the practice-changing stuff is awesome when it happens, but if you're on top of your game, you know, you should know it's coming. And so for me, like you say, a lot of ASCO is about looking to where the puck is going to be and trying to spot the trends coming in the future. But let's dig into ADAURA. Okay, so ADAURA, we all know, 3 years of adjuvant osimertinib, post-resection of EGFR mutant lung cancer, primary endpoint disease-free survival that we saw, you know, was prolonged, although the difference between the 2020 follow-up and the 2023 was those curves were coming back together. And then this year we saw overall survival with a hazard ratio of about 0.49. Was that a surprise to you? I mean, how do you interpret that?
No, I don't think so, Ross. I think we all were counting on having an overall survival benefit. I think the devils are obviously in the details. And I think the criticism from this trial is that the patients who received second-line treatment after progression, only less than half of them received osimertinib. And so I think there's a lot of chatter about whether or not that's truly up to date in terms of how we treat patients. And I know, you know, in some resource-poor countries, osimertinib is obviously not going to be as available as it is in U.S. and other countries. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, Ross, this is still a very important treatment that I think I'm going to certainly continue to offer to patients. I guess I'll say one other thing that was a little bit swept under the rug was that if you actually look at the different stages and their benefits, the earlier stage, the 1B and 2s, it did appear as though the confidence interval did cross 1. So I think overall, yes, there certainly was clinically meaningful benefit in overall survival. If I had this dreaded disease with EGFR, I absolutely would go on osimertinib for 3 years, despite all the press about not getting osimertinib in the progressors on the placebo arm, I still think this is a very good option for patients. How about you?
Well, I like to pull it apart. On the one hand, you know, academics like to talk. So there's one bit which is like the chatter doesn't matter. You know, there's an improvement in overall survival, and therefore you're going to give it. And all of the discussion about why kind of doesn't matter. It's like saying, do we understand why the sun comes up in the morning? Well, the sun comes up in the morning. So that's the important thing. But the reason why the discussion about why there's an overall survival benefit is going to matter, not the second you start a patient on it, but when you get to those 3 years. So let me try and explain. So the only way you can improve overall survival in an adjuvant study is three ways. So the first is easy. The patients who get the osimertinib who relapse later are being treated with the medicine of 5 years' time as opposed to the medicine of now. So that's the oncology time machine. And, you know, you've got 3 years on osimertinib, you stop it, and if you're not cured, this is not metastatic disease, this is microscopic. It's going to take a couple of years before it emerges. So if I said, Jeremy, you've got EGFR mutant lung cancer, do you want to be treated with 2018 medicine or 2023 medicine? You go 2023. That's a given. The second one is the elephant in the room is, are you actually curing more people? And as the disease-free survival curves come together, it looks like maybe you're not. I know Roy Herbst has put on the record that he thinks they won't come together, but they actually stopped disease-free survival follow-up after that second analysis. So we will never see that information. And then the last one, which is what you touched on in terms of the controversy, is it's nothing to do with curing people. It's simply to do with the fact that a group of people who in the experimental arm, 100% of them get osimertinib, and in the control arm, all the people who aren't cured by the surgery and the adjuvant chemotherapy, they don't get access to it. So it's just about access. There was a little bit of sleight of hand here. So what they showed was the frequency of different treatments among those who got subsequent treatment, presumably on progression. What you really want to see is the proportion of people who got osimertinib who died. So if you dropped down dead, never got a treatment, you wouldn't appear in that list of people who didn't get subsequent treatment. And also you want to know the people who really where the impact was, which is they died relatively quickly and contributed to that overall survival. So that's about 80 patients in the control arm, maybe about 20 or 40 patients in the OSI arm. If you show me that and you show me 20% of people get osimertinib, you can't pull apart the fact this is just access. And the reason all that matters is if you don't think there's a cure, when you get to 3 years, do you tell the patient you're probably cured, we don't need to surveil you anymore, off you go, live your life? Or do you say, look, we have kicked the can down the road, and now we have to start surveillance again because you may not be cured? And for me, that's the important thing. And people are even talking about, do you stay on the OSI for life? Which is obviously great if you're trying to sell the drug. But that's what I think is going on here. So I think it was a well-constructed study. I think it's beautiful in the way it's making us think more about things. But I think there's a difference between an overall survival advantage and actually curing people.
So what is your gut instinct? Are you curing people?
No, I don't think we are. I think those curves are coming together. I mean, it becomes slightly silly. So let's say, you know, they talk about sort of duration of osimertinib. And sure, if I put you on it for 20 years, I may not cure you, but, you know, maybe you die from something else. So there's obviously a factor in there. So I think we should do it. My biggest worry is people will believe that they're cured and they will have inadequate surveillance. And I think the other thing is, let's say it is access. It works for AstraZeneca's advantage because it says, look, if you do relapse, man, you've got to go on osimertinib, not diddle around with other things.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Ross, let me ask you a provocative question. What should we do about other targetable mutations with excellent response rates with TKIs? Can we extrapolate? So your patient with a ROS1 or an ALK translocation, I know there's no FDA indication, but I'm already starting to see some evidence of this, of people using adjuvant TKIs in these early stage patients. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, they're clearly going to have disease-free survival advantage. I think the beauty of osimertinib is it's actually pretty well tolerated. And so apart from the cost, there's no big downside. I think going on, you know, 3 years of brigatinib, 3 years of crizotinib is probably feasible in some of these things. 3 years on lorlatinib, I don't know that that's a great idea if you might be cured from the surgery. So I think, you know, there are some issues here. 3 years of a BRAF-MEK combination doesn't sound like that much fun if you don't really need it.
I hear you. I totally agree. I think the beauty of this is that osimertinib is a tolerable drug that you can take for 3 years. And even despite that, there still was a relatively big proportion of patients, not huge, that did discontinue treatment, either due to inconvenience or therapy, you know, or treatment-related AEs. But nonetheless, these do have side effects. And we certainly know from our patient advocates that, you know, when we say, oh, patient's great, doing wonderful, that there's still a lot of underlying toxicity that we may not be picking up in our kind of standard instruments and our kind of brief interactions with these patients.
Let me throw out two things here. So one of the other things that makes me think this isn't a cure is there was a neat little study from UCSF presented by Jacqueline Aredo, and this was neoadjuvant osimertinib in those with L858R exon 19 deletion. And okay, so they only got it for, you know, about 2 months maybe before surgery, but there was a zero pathological complete response rate. Now, okay, the naysayers would go, well, that's not 3 years of therapy. But, you know, there's nothing there, given that chemo can produce a pathological complete response rate, you know, to suggest that this is really obliterating these things completely. So again, it goes against the whole, you know, are you curing people? Which brings me back to one other thing. Okay, so even though this wasn't the function of ADAURA, how do you view the role of adjuvant chemotherapy in EGFR mutant lung cancer these days?
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough one. I think I'm going to take the party line, which is what, you know, Roy had said in his presentation, that this is not a substitute for chemotherapy, that the standard of care still is chemotherapy, and then if an EGFR mutation followed by osimertinib. I think for the reasons that you also touched on, it's potentially not curative. And so I would still argue that chemotherapy has a role here, even though I would love to say to a patient, there's no role for chemotherapy now. I think that would be a wonderful thing to tell a patient, but I'm not there yet.
And I totally agree with you, because actually there's some soft evidence here. And so they did do a breakdown in terms of overall survival by those who did and didn't receive adjuvant chemotherapy. And the delta looks fairly similar between osimertinib and placebo. And you might look at that and go, well, so you don't need adjuvant chemo. But actually, what you're not appreciating is that they weren't randomized to get adjuvant chemo. The ones who got adjuvant chemo were actually, you know, some of the poorer actors, higher stage disease. And so if you look at the control arm, the ones that, you know, either did or didn't get adjuvant chemo, but didn't get anything else, the fact that they look similar to me tells me the adjuvant chemo actually lifted up those higher risk patients to look more like the lower risk patients. So I think that kind of fits. And also, you know, let's step back and sort of, you know, do a conspiracy theory. Given that FLAURA2 we know is a positive study, so that's metastatic disease, osimertinib plus or minus platinum pemetrexed, kind of, you know, will fit with the AstraZeneca narrative that chemo and osimertinib together are not mutually exclusive. They may be beneficial. So they're not cannibalizing their own message if they sort of keep saying, you know, adjuvant chemotherapy, keep doing it.
I think those are great points. Despite that, I will bet you a foam finger from the next carnival ride that there are going to be people who are not going to do chemotherapy. They are going to say, here's your osimertinib. You don't need chemo. That's a side topic.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, kind of early stage disease kind of had a bit of a moment at ASCO. So the other thing that it seemed like there were lots, in fact, there was probably only two presentations of the whole, what they call perioperative chemoimmunotherapy. So we'd seen neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy with CheckMate 816. We'd seen adjuvant stuff with the, you know, IMpower 010. And then this was kind of like a bit of chemoimmunotherapy before, and then a whole bunch of immunotherapy after your surgery. And we saw the Aegean presented earlier in the year, and then we got Keynote 471, and Neotorch presented here with different agents. And it seemed like, you know, every flipping time they did it, the same discussion stood up and go that, well, this is cool, but we actually don't know whether you need the adjuvant immunotherapy after the neoadjuvant. So what's your take?
I think there's something about the human psychology about always liking new things. I got a new Apple Watch that goes from 50 to 100 meters. And I don't even dive, but I was excited about it. And I think this is another example of this is a really kind of the treatments that we know of that are very effective. We're just moving into a different place, and it's obviously generated a ton of interest. I would say that CheckMate 816, which is still kind of the first, you know, readout that we had of a very impressive improvement in disease-free survival and also now likely overall survival, in particular the patients with a path CR, do so well. And so I think this is going to be a very, very interesting area where I believe most clinicians are going to probably give adjuvant immunotherapy despite or regardless of the pathologic response. I do think this certainly opens the door for future, you know, studies how you design them will obviously be really important, and whether or not the control arm is more immunotherapy versus, you know, observation. But Ross, I think this is going to change the field. I think it's already changing the field, but I think there's going to be a lot of people who, if they try this approach, and once they have that first patient who has progressive disease or doesn't make it to surgery, they're going to be stung. And I think they're going to really kind of say to themselves, do I really want to do this? Because that's the worst outcome, is that you don't get that patient to definitive therapy. So how are you kind of integrating this into your practice?
So two things. So one is, I think we all like CheckMate 816, and it's not clear to me that, you know, adding a year of immunotherapy after neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy adds anything other than cost and inconvenience. And, you know, you bring up the really interesting point of like, well, so who needs the adjuvant chemo? The ones who clearly benefited with a pathological CR, or the ones who didn't benefit and they just need more time? Or is that like, you know, throwing good money after bad? So at the moment, I've got to say, I'm still probably going to stick with CheckMate 816 and hold off on the adjuvant therapy. I totally open to a trial that kind of randomized you to get or not get the adjuvant immunotherapy, stratified by whether you had a path CR. But you bring up this other really important point, like 20% of patients don't get to surgery, but that was the same in both the experimental and the treatment arms. And you're right, you know, choosing our patients who, you know, can and can't get to surgery. I mean, that's a whole issue. You know, one in five patients, we're going to totally blow it. So, you know, how do we figure out who those patients are?
Yeah, I think this really highlights the importance of a multidisciplinary tumor board too, and really making sure that you have a surgeon who's there and is paying attention during this tumor board. And you say to that person, is this somebody who is surgically resectable right now? Not after three cycles of chemo or four cycles of chemo immunotherapy and quote unquote downstage them. And I think that's going to be a really important point. I think people are going to kind of automatically assume, oh, this patient's got, they're not a surgical candidate right now because they've got bilateral mediastinal disease or, you know, some other, you know, factor that would not make them a surgical candidate. But if I give them some neoadjuvant chemo immunotherapy, maybe that can then kind of push them into that resectable category. And I think it's important that that was not the intent of these studies. And so I think that's where it's going to be really important for everybody to have appropriate staging based on PET scan and, you know, mediastinal sampling if necessary. And also, most importantly, that surgical colleague at your multidisciplinary team who can tell you, yes, this person's resectable right now, not potentially down the road.
So you think they were kind of like people who are like borderline resectable, and then they probably should have just gone straight to surgery. Although here's the other thing, you know, if you go from resectable to not resectable in 6 weeks, you've got bad disease.
True. Yeah, there's that kind of biological endpoint that we always talk about, that somebody's just got unfortunate bad biology. And if they had went to surgery right out of the gates, they would progress shortly thereafter surgery. So at the end of the day, these are the really kind of the patients who have very bad underlying disease that, you know, we just don't have a good answer for. I am very careful in who I'm recommending this for.
So EGFR, you know, we have fairly good evidence. So we had the Keynote 789, which is kind of like an important negative study. So this was like your EGFR mutant, you progress on your TKI, and then you're randomized to platinum pemetrexed with or without pembrolizumab. And it was like a stunningly negative study. So I certainly think knowing your EGFR status before you're entertaining neoadjuvant chemo immunotherapy is important. So my question to you is, are you going to extend that logic to other driver oncogenes? So if you knew you had a ROS1 or an ALK, well, then, you know, a BRAF, would you not give them chemoimmunotherapy and be more like to rush straight to surgery?
My take on this is that chemo does work in these patients. You know, I think the addition of the immunotherapy component is really the tricky part. You know, we certainly know, just as you had said, based on, you know, CheckMate 789, that the addition of immunotherapy, at least in the metastatic setting, doesn't really have much of a benefit. But Ross, I think this creates a really challenging situation, because now you have a patient who's got potentially resectable, curable cancer sitting in front of you. And now we have to make sure we have enough tissue to run not just two genes, but potentially more genes. Yeah. And so that's going to set the clock back another 3 to 4 weeks. Meanwhile, the patient's sitting there saying, okay, well, I've got this cancer growing and you're not starting me on treatment. You know, this, I think, continues to highlight the importance of molecular testing, but also the pitfalls of molecular testing. And right now, in this situation, the time is really critical. This is what makes me most nervous, is when I'm waiting for this testing to come back, on, especially on somebody who I think has a very low pretest probability of having a targetable mutation. So like most speakers, I'm not going to answer your question directly. I'm just going to talk around
it's like talking to a politician. Well, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, there was actually a kind of neat study. I mean, some of the gems are always hidden in the posters. There was a Japanese study, and the Japanese are very big in terms of, you know, molecular profiling. But they showed that their time to initiating first-line treatment based on targeted therapy was, you know, 38 days, I think, if when they were doing tissue, which is clearly, you know, if you're sitting there with resectable cancer, that is unacceptable. One of the things that there wasn't much here, but there's some stuff going on behind the scenes, is the role of AI, because that's terribly pop. We have to bring that up. Of, you know, how like you have a, you know, you're a neat pathologist who can look down the microscope and say, well, you know, I think this is more likely to be ALK or EGFR, and that's a game they play. What if there was an actual AI that was actually much better than your pathologist and can really give you that tipping their hand? I mean, that could come back in seconds, and it doesn't have to be perfect, but it might be enough to kind of, you know, make that treatment decision about giving or not giving adjuvant immunotherapy might be useful. Anyway, that's the future.
That's incredible.
That's what I hope. I mean, it's a little scary because it's a black box, but you know, that's coming from lots of different directions. Speaking of biomarkers, let me, this is a clever segue, you see. So now I'm going to move to amivantamab. And, you know, one of the presentations that I really liked for a number of different reasons was the AmiLaser post-osimertinib study, which was part of Chrysalis 2, which you'd previously seen had a 36% response rate and duration of response of about 9.6 months. And last year, I think I gave the Janssen people a hard time because they also did this subsequent thing, like in an unselected population. And it looked like they were saying, look, let's, you know, take the 36% and just, you know, say thank you. But they had already shown the year before, maybe on about like 10 or 12 patients, that a MET EGFR combined AHC could separate out those with a 90 versus 10% response rate. And we got this update now in over 100 patients. And now, like the EGFR IHC has disappeared, but just using MET IHC, in fact, the same assay that's used for Teliso-V, and if you were positive, you had a 61% response rate to AmiLaser post-OSI and 12% if you were MET negative. And again, PFS not reached versus 4.1 months. And so, first of all, it's like, so, you know, your small study was kind of bogus and now you've updated, which is good. But what does all of this mean for your development plan? I mean, AmiLaser, remember, is being developed in Mariposa 2, which is you progress on OSI and it's chemo or chemo plus AmiLaser. I mean, does this take the legs out from under it?
Well, I guess I'd have to ask you. But
I would say,
right back at you. You know, Ross, I think this, again, highlights the importance of biopsying these patients on progression on osimertinib. And that's really challenging, though. I think we really underplay how hard it can be to get tissue on these patients, especially if a lot of these studies require core biopsies or larger tissue samples. And for a lot of patients, we're just not able to get that. But that's not your question. It's just kind of me on my soapbox. But I think we love to slice and dice the pie of the molecular therapies. And I think this is a really good example of where this is potentially beneficial for patients, is for these 10 to 15% of patients with MET amplified post-OC EGFR mutated lung cancer. I think there's a pathway for a prolonged response, probably with better tolerability than chemotherapy. But I guess, you know, my question would be, at this point, you know, given where we're at with the science of everything, is how do you design a trial moving forward now in this MET amplified space? I mean, I know you've published on this recently in JCO. It's a moving target. The minute you have, you know, one answer, it seems like there's another piece of data out there that you have to include in your trial design. So it's like, by the time we actually do a study looking at MET amplified, I mean, who knows what we'll find by the time it reads out. So it's kind of like, what does the practicing clinician do right now with a MET amplified patient without, you know, having access to a clinical trial? It's still, in my view, a really hard question that there's no right answer.
Let me take that in a slightly different direction. So the first thing is, this isn't just about MET amplification. This is MET IHC, which is about positive in about 30, 35% of patients. Amplification is probably lower, 10%, 20%, depending on how you define it. So there could be MET as a vulnerability to drugs such as amivantamab, definable by MET IHC, and the same argument would go for MET-directed ADCs. So that's one. But I think this is a positive move. The idea of having a targeted therapy and giving it to an unselected population and saying, look, you know, there's a 36% response rate, isn't that awesome, is ridiculous. We know it's heterogeneous in terms of mechanisms of resistance. And this is beginning to say, look, not everybody might need AMI, different groups will. And that's what's going to come in the future. We're going to profile people post-OSSE, and there will be MET positive people defined in different ways, some amplification, some by protein expression. There will be other driver oncogenes. You know, we know RET, ALK, you know, all the things that we thought were mutually exclusive can come back in the best supporting actor role in the acquired resistance. And then there's on-target resistance with C797S. And then we actually saw some data here with Blueprint's 945 drug showing when you combined it with OSSE, they had about a 50% response rate in about, you know, there's like 8 or 9 patients here who had C797S. So we're the idea that profiling people and putting them to different bins when they're first diagnosed is important, just as important in the acquired resistance setting. So, no, I mean, you threw it out at the beginning. There's lots of, hey, this is interesting and this might go here. So what did you find exciting out of all of the stuff that was shown? You know, what made you go, one to watch?
I would say to you that I'm always kind of a big fan of improving tolerability and reducing toxicity. I have to say, I know this wasn't like the sexiest abstract, but the new KRAS G12C inhibitor, this JDQ443, it looked like there was a lot less grade 3-4 liver toxicity. And, you know, I know KRAS inhibitors are not the equivalent of EGFR inhibitors. So I think, you know, for me, KRAS inhibitors have kind of been a little bit of like a wah, wah. But that is promising to me because I think that those types of toxicities are real and they require dose discontinuations and all sorts of stress and anxiety in patients. So I'm always happy to have drugs that work that have less toxicity. I would say that to me was something that I'm very excited to see a little bit more about down the road. I'll say, take a small segue, that I think, you know, the newest, latest, greatest group of drugs is the ADCs. I will be really interested to know how are these ADCs going to hold up to randomized studies when it comes to moving to that next line. I think in this ASCO, we heard a lot about a lot of promising ADCs.
Yeah.
And I think the question is where do they go from there? And you know, how do they compare to our traditional chemotherapy backbones? From what I'm seeing, these ADCs do have still some myelosuppressive toxicities, grade 3-4. But maybe less than chemotherapy. But it seems to me like we've kind of moved past this. This ASCO was not about, okay, let's add Pembro or Nevo or whatever checkpoint to chemo and see what happens. We've kind of moved beyond that. And now we're going to that next class of agents. And so that's what's really exciting about this. And I'll be really interested in the next 2 to 3 years to kind of figure out where do these play out in our kind of armamentarium of treatments.
Let's break some of that down. So the JDQ443 is Eli Lilly's KRAS G12C inhibitor. And, you know, having been on the other side in pharmaceutical industry, I always like to sort of, you know, see the strings which are moving. It's a bit like sort of, you know, if you're a movie director, you can see when they're setting up the scene and you know what's going to happen next. So why do they spend all this time telling you about ALT and AST issues, given that the major issues with adagrasib and sotorasib is probably more GI issues? So you got an idea on that one? Why do they focus on the ALT and the AST?
Because that had better toxicity profile. I don't know.
No, it's because the future for G12C inhibitors is who can get to first line. And to get to first line, because you've got a 30 to 40% response rate, you're going to have to combine it with something. And because these are often smokers, it's going to have to include immunotherapy. And sotorasib went, oops, you know, they had a whole bunch of transaminitis. Adagrasib was saying, we've got some, but less. So this is Lilly saying, I know we're late to the game, but hey, look, maybe our background incidence of ALT and AST is lower. So we might be the preferred combination partner for immunotherapy. That's what they're really tipping their hand by saying this. They also had a 57% response rate, which is pretty neat, but it was only 14 patients before we get too excited about that. So is it one to watch or is it just a me too drug? I don't know. It's kind of so far so good. The other thing about, you know, these things is it takes some time for the transaminitis to manifest. So if you do a data cut that's like, you know, 2 weeks in, no one's got transaminitis, way to go. And it's like, well, you know, show me what it looks like at 3 months or 6 months. So I think it's like, fine, we'll keep an eye on it. Am I super excited that it's something different? I don't know yet. But let's talk about the ADCs, because I do think, you know, this is this tsunami of new classes of drugs coming. And like you say, there's like a gazillion different ones. For me, one of the ones that really made me sit up and take notice was the B7H3 drug that was tried in small cell lung cancer and had something crazy, like an 80% response rate. And then you dig into the details and you go, well, it's only 9 patients, and 7 of the 9, like 4 of them weren't confirmed responses. So at worst, it's a 30% response rate, which is still pretty cool. But, you know, you got to be careful of the kind of sleight of hands that we do when we're trying to sell you early stage data. So that one was interesting. And then, you know, you kind of touched on it. It's like, where are these going to go? We saw the Tropion 2 study, which is the TROP2 ADC from Daiichi. And that was like, you know, clearly the beauty of TROP2 is they argue that it's so common, you don't need to pre-select. So it's the perfect first line drug. And so they were doing it in combination with pembrolizumab. They were doing it in a swap out version where it was like platinum, pembrolizumab, and then the TROP2 agent. And, you know, maybe it was safe. I don't know what I made of the efficacy. The combination with pembrolizumab had about a 50% response rate. PD-L1 levels in theory across all different levels is kind of interesting. And yet their combination with platinum, pemetrexed, pembrolizumab only had about the same response rate. And that was kind of like a little disappointing. So, you know, when you've got this heterogeneous population, I don't know that this made me go, wow, there's something going on here. But at least it appeared reasonably well tolerated. Which other ADCs caught your eye?
I agree with you about the TROP2 inhibitor. It did seem like at least the triplet therapy, which included the Dato-DX and Pembro and chemo, that overall response rate of 57%-ish was not that exciting to me, you know, especially compared to, you know, Keynote-89 or kind of our general treatments. That's why I think, you know, when you randomize a study in patients with, you know, let's say newly metastatic, you know, non-small cell lung cancer, and they either get the triplet therapy in that study or, you know, your standard chemo IO, I'm not sure what that's going to show. And I, you know, worry about, you know, hundreds of patients going on treatments that might not be any better, but that's why we do the trials. I'm not sure that I have a really great answer for you as to which ADC was the one that I was really kind of pinning a lot of hopes on. There definitely was a lot of now targeted therapies in small cell. And I guess, I think we're finally moving away from, you know, giving all comers the same chemo and seeing what happens. What are your thoughts on the whole small cell landscape? I think you and I may have a little bit of a difference of agreement with to how optimistic one might be in the small cell space. I still feel terrible for these patients. I still think this is a cancer for which we have very few answers. But with that being said, they are moving ahead and we are now, you know, selecting patients based on biomarkers. And so I'm going to put you on the record. What do you think?
We talked about the B7-H3, which is a TOPO1 warhead ADC, and the 9 patients of whom either 7 or 3, depending on whether you wanted confirmed ones or not, responded. And that was from Hanso Pharmaceuticals. And that I thought was interesting. I'll give you the positive and the negative in small cell for me this year. So I would say the positive is the second drug in the BiTE class coming out. So we saw data from Boehringer Ingelheim's 764532, which is a DLL3 CD3 bispecific T-cell engager. And let me try and explain how these things work for those listening. So it's kind of like one end binds to delta light ligand 3, which is expressed on about 70 to 80% of small cell. And then the other end bends to CD3, which is on T cells and also acts as a T cell co-stimulatory molecule. And so it's kind of like a matchmaker with a little bit of aphrodisiac thrown in there. And, you know, the response rate in this group of people pre-selected for DLL3 was about 20%. And those who responded, it seemed to last for months and months and months, which looked really awesome. And they didn't give a median, but they showed a kind of swimmer's plot. So for me, you know, it's not everybody who's DLL3 positive. So it's a bit like if this is a matchmaker, you know, sometimes you put these two things together and it's like putting two rabbits together. And then sometimes it's like putting two pandas together and absolutely nothing happens. But, you know, I'd say 20% of rabbits is still way better than nothing that like we had in small cell. So I was excited about that. And, you know, there's another company called Harpoon who's also getting into this space. And so maybe it's not an answer for everybody. And so, but in the world of small cell, you know, it really is the kind of one-eyed man is king. And so, yeah, I was excited about that. But you were a bit more kind of grinchy on that one.
Well, I think, Rossi, when it comes to patient selection for, you know, these small cell studies, these are usually kind of like the Olympians of clinical trials, you know, patients who have small cell, which is a bad cancer. They then are, you know, still alive and relatively well post first line and maybe even second line, well enough to go onto a clinical trial with an ECOG 0-1. I think the small cell population, just because of the nature of all the comorbid conditions, it's such a challenging cancer. So you may have a very promising drug, and then when you start to use it in more of a general population, I think things then start to become a lot more challenging. And so swimmer's plots are really always exciting. They're visually stimulating. And I do want to be hopeful for small cell. I do. In my heart of hearts, I want this to work. I just am inherently skeptical of new treatments in general, but also in ones where we don't truly know how this is going to perform in a bigger population, and certainly comparing it to randomization to standard chemo or whatever the second line option is at the time.
That's true. And it's not free from side effects. You get, you know, capillary or a cytokine release syndrome, which can be sort of unpleasant, especially in kind of, you know, a more frail patient. That was my positive in small cell. My negative small cell was, unfortunately, the SWOG 1929 study, which was this kind of interesting kind of proof of principle in terms of feasibility of doing a study. And yet the clinical outcome, I thought, was rather disappointing. So Nagla Karim presented this idea based on prior information that in a study with small cell that was a PARP inhibitor plus temozolomide, the presence or absence of this marker called SLARFIN-11 seemed to separate out median overall survival by about 4 or 5 months. So they did a prospectively selected study. Patients who are going on their initial therapy, they're screened for SLARFIN-11 positivity. And then when they get to the maintenance stage of their initial chemoimmunotherapy, they were randomized to atezolizumab alone or atezolizumab plus talazoparib, which is a PARP inhibitor. And I mean, seriously, there was no difference in response rate. There was no difference in overall survival, which was actually the primary endpoint. And the median, you know, improved from 2.8 to 4.2 months with a hazard ratio of 0.7 that, you know, you had to do a p-value that was kind of higher than we might normally use. So they had used 10% significance to even show it was is beneficial. So I was pretty disappointed. And then the real reason is, you know, what was the SLARFIN-11 positivity rate? It was like 80%. It's like, that is not a predictive biomarker. That's like, you know, if it didn't work in everybody, sort of, you know, losing 20% of people is not going to suddenly give you a miraculous response. So that kind of like looked like triumph of you can do a pre-selected study in small cell and an epic failure of the science, I'd say.
So do you think at this point, what's more important, the drug or the biomarker?
Well, I think what you really want, you know, is evidence that there are some people who do amazingly well on your drug and then use the biomarker to enrich it. If you have no evidence that anyone does amazingly well, you can have all the biomarkers in the world. It's like there's no diamond in the rough if there's no diamond there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that that SWOG study did highlight, again, to me, a little bit of my pessimism of, and maybe it's just, as you had said, a very more or less ubiquitous biomarker, but it does feel as though we have these biomarkers, we have drugs that potentially treat them, and then unfortunately they kind of are not that beneficial in a randomized kind of larger study. But again, that's just the nature of small cell, I believe.
We can't go through a discussion about ASCO 2023 without talking about Tumor Treating Fields, the LUNA study. So this was totally left field. And there were cool posters of what I think was supposed to be a chess piece that was sort of, you know, lit up like it came from Tron all over the conference center saying, you know, make your next move electric. Although it did look a little bit like a Dalek from Doctor Who to me. Jeremy, what did you make of Tumor Treating Fields?
Well, they did have a really visually appealing booth at ASCO. I will give them that. Again, I'm inherently skeptical about new therapies, and this, I think, highlights some of that skepticism. So, you know, wearing electrodes on your chest for 18 hours a day, I think is going to inherently come with some certain challenges, especially depending on what you do for a living, et cetera. But with that being said, it's very easy to throw stones at a house and say, oh, look at this study. It had this wrong. And I'll kind of tell you what those things were. But I do believe that new therapies absolutely are needed in non-small cell lung cancer. And so this is one step forward in that.
You know, you're not consistent because you're skeptical of new therapies in small cell, and yet you love the idea of new therapies in non-small cell. I'm sensing a prejudice here.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely. I never said that it was logical. It just, you know, I'm going from the heart here.
Okay, go for it.
So the LUNAR study was a really interesting study looking at second-line treatment, dealer's choice chemotherapy, plus or minus Tumor Treating Field technology. And so, you know, what they showed was that there was an overall survival benefit. However, when you look at the subset analysis, it appeared as though the ones who got the most benefit were the ones who had gotten immunotherapy plus the Tumor Treating Fields versus the dealer's choice chemotherapy. So while overall it was a positive study, it does suggest that most of the benefit were seen in the patients who got immunotherapy. The problem is, Ross, is that, as you know, is that we give immunotherapy up front now in first line in a vast majority of patients. So this is a good example of a study that showed an overall survival benefit in a probably different standard of care than we're practicing right now. So in other words, it's very rare for a patient to have single agent immunotherapy in the second line these days.
Okay.
So that's the first point. The second point is that there was a very large percentage of patients who we did not know their PD-L1 status.
Yeah.
So to be exact, 49%. So while there was a balance between the two arms in terms of PD-L unknown, this is a huge deal. 20% of their patients were high PD-L1 versus the control arm, which had, you know, zero. So, I mean, to me, that's a critical, critical fact here that you just have to be mindful of when kind of looking at this benefit in these immunotherapy patients. So if we're buying or selling right now on the stock, I'm on the stock market, I'm selling right now. I'm not buying right now. I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait, Ross.
No, I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, so there was no real difference in progression-free survival or response rate, although they didn't break that down by whether they were getting docetaxel or immune checkpoint. That always makes me suspicious. It's like, look over here, don't look over there. And then this huge kind of like, you know, 50% of the patients with a total wild card that could totally have shifted the results. And it was a smallish study, you know, I think there were like 60 patients in each arm once you got down to the ICI, the immune checkpoint inhibitor kind of group. The thing is, it's a device. And so the licensing for device with the FDA is different for drug. And so it's probably out there and you can use it already. The question is, are people going to suddenly adopt it based on this? Or are they going to wait for a more definitive, you know, Keynote 189 plus or minus, you know, your electric straitjacket? And, you know, for me, I'm going to be in the second camp like you.
I'm glad we can agree on something, Ross.
So apart from the Tumor Treating Fields, what I really like is to spot, you know, the sleights of hand, or, you know, in the negative side, the kind of, you know, the willfully misleading, or in the positive side, that, you know, they missed some variable that, you know, we, the smart audience, picked up. So were there any kind of like aha moments for you when you were seeing some of these presentations?
Well, I would say there's still a lot of unanswered questions that this ASCO did not really provide definitive data on. So okay, whether or not this is an aha moment or not, abstract 9101 by Sun did use Flatiron data to determine whether or not there's any benefit in continuing immunotherapy past 2 years in patients with metastatic disease. And so, you know, there's a lot of controversy as to what the right thing to do is, so on and so forth. I think these are the issues that are really, really important for multiple reasons. There's a lot of caveats with these types of big data. I fully admit that, Ross. And generally speaking, I consider these types of data points hypothesis generating, not necessarily definitive.
Okay.
But this is at least one thing that was interesting, one piece of data that was interesting that suggested there was no improvement in overall survival by stopping at 2 years versus continuing. So was it an aha moment? No, maybe it was just reinforcing my bias. And that's, you know, kind of a dangerous thing.
Still, what is your bias?
My bias is to stop it at 2 years.
Okay.
I've been bitten recently by continuing it past 2 years and causing some irreversible immune related toxicity, Ross. So I think, you know, I've been overly influenced by doing that.
It's a really intriguing thing. Like you say, these aren't randomized studies and they're kind of provocative, but it almost feeds back into how we started this discussion about, you know, if you had neoadjuvant therapy and you have a path CR, do you need more? And, you know, maybe the people who get to 2 years have just sort of declared themselves like, you know, they're doing great. They actually don't need any more. And, you know, do you constantly need to throw more life jackets at somebody who's already been saved? So I think that's interesting. Of course, those studies, you know, discontinuation of treatment are unlikely to be done by a drug company because there's nothing useful in it, but it might be done by a cooperative group or someone. One of the studies I saw that, you know, made me go, aha, was a very intriguing study presented by Alex Drillin about something called a SHP2 inhibitor. So SHP2 is one of the things other than the kinase domain that causes signaling inside of cells from specific oncogenes. And the idea was, it's a kind of neat study design. You're various different oncogene-driven subtypes of lung cancer. You're on your TKI, you're progressing. And then they stop the TKI. They give you about 6 weeks on the SHP2 inhibitor alone. And then they add back in the same TKI. and they showed it wasn't particularly badly tolerated. And they were very excited because they talked about, you know, a couple of responses, one in ALK, one in ROS1, both treated with lorlatinib, who claimed to have a response when they reintroduced the lorlatinib. But I'm incredibly skeptical because the one figure that they actually showed, which was supposedly with stable disease, was somebody with a BRAF mutant. And you could see that they didn't have detectable cfDNA when they initially stopped their TKI combination. It came up during that time just on the SHP2 inhibitor and the cancer actually grew. And then you add back in the same drug and hey presto, it goes back to undetectable. And the tumor shrinks down, not below the level it was, but to the level it was before. So, you know, without additional data, I'm skeptical that this is, you know, anything than just a rechallenge response. And what I'd really want to know is a response that was defined relative to the baseline before you started monotherapy, not relative to what you look like when you progressed on the monotherapy.
Yeah, it almost sounds like they were setting themselves up to achieve that endpoint, which is to get back to the starting point potentially by stopping the active drug and then restarting it again.
Yeah, so I'm super skeptical about that one. Was there anything else that made you go, ooh?
Well, I guess I'll say this. I still think for doctors like you and me who treat mesothelioma and others, there is still a very much a void as to what to do. And so I think this year's ASCO did provide one further study, IND227, which was an ex-US study looking at pembro plus cispem versus cispem or chemotherapy. And so the press releases, it's positive that pembrolizumab did improve overall survival, not by a huge amount, a little over 1 month.
But oh, this was the Canadian study.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Our neighbors to the north. Yeah. And there's still a lot of unknown as to which of these patients respond to immunotherapy. I don't think this kind of was to me a, wow, this is amazing. We definitely need to use pembro plus chemotherapy in every patient. We still don't truly know the role of bevacizumab in these patients. And so to me, there still is a lot of unanswered questions as to what is your first line treatment with your metastatic or your locally advanced mesothelioma patient, Ross. I don't know whether or not you do immunotherapy first. Do you do chemotherapy first? Now, do the combination? Of course, you know, there's always going to be questions as to what your second line treatment option is if you've used your chemo and immunotherapy up front. So I would say to me, that still is one of the biggest kind of questions that really we have still no resolution for.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were sarcomatoid, give you the immunotherapy up first. If you're not, I'm going to tend to give you carboplatin and pemetrexed. I usually hold the Bev and then, you know, keep the immunotherapy for later. But yeah, I mean, it was a kind of positive study and I think it was a well-conducted study. Is it transformative? No. You know, does it set the scene for saying, let's do immunotherapy and bevacizumab and chemotherapy? You know, there may be some synergy there, but, you know, it's hard to do studies in mesothelioma. Props to the Canadians for doing it, but yeah, not really transformative in my mind. I mean, I think we could talk for hours about it, or, you know, all of the nuances here, but let's wrap it up in the interest of the attention span of our listeners. So give me a 1 second takeaway from ASCO 2023 for you.
ASCO 2023, I think, set the stage for future treatments in terms of, I think, ADCs was probably the big takeaway. I think, again, we've moved away from this immunotherapy plus chemo paradigm. And now I think we're moving to that next group of drugs. Whether or not it truly is going to be a practice change and whether or not they're better than our standard therapy, I'm skeptical, Ross, but hopeful.
For me, the lasting impression of ASCO 2023 was that it was going on during the 3-day Taylor Swift concert at Soldier Field. And one day, some Swifties got a little lost. And so a group of pre-teenage girls wearing their sparkly miniskirts and cowboy boots walked through the ASCO conference, which was... That's when I wished I'd had a camera. And on that note, thanks for listening.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.